The premier event for infection prevention and control is coming to San Antonio this June. APIC annual conference brings you the latest research, innovative products, and practical knowledge to help you prevent infection. From inspiring keynotes to thought-provoking panel discussions, APIC 24 curates an extraordinary platform for knowledge exchange. Meet IPs from around the world who face the same daily challenges as you. If you work in infection prevention and control, you don't want to miss this event. Learn more and register to join us in person or virtually at annual.apic.org.
You are listening to the 5-Second Rule podcast presented by APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology. This podcast is produced by the APIC Communications Committee and is intended to be a conversation between our hosts and professionals practicing in the infection prevention and control industry. You will learn and be entertained, but most of all, we hope you will be inspired by our community and the work of our peers. And now, on to the show.
The following is a special episode of the 5-Second Rule. We interviewed infection preventionists live at the 2023 annual APIC conference in Orlando, where they discussed their poster presentations and oral abstracts. You'll hear from Emily Gaddam, who discusses Candida auris, Benjamin Galvin, who shares insights from a new infection prevention director, and Harry Zinn and Marissa Yee, who overviewed their project on sustaining hand hygiene compliance. If you're inspired by this episode, the call for speakers at APIC's 2024 conference is open until August 20th, 2023. On October 30th, the call for abstracts will open. Find more details in the show notes. We'd love to potentially interview you at next year's conference. Now, on to the show.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Lorenza Howard, live at the APIC conference, and my pronouns are she, her.
Hi, this is Kelly Holmes. My pronouns are also she, her. So happy to be here.
So happy to be here. First time attendee. So I'm very much so enjoying myself with this 2023 APIC conference experience. So today we have a very special guest, Benjamin Galvin, who has a poster presentation that was accepted at the APIC conference. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So Ben, tell us the name of your poster.
Absolutely. So it's a 90-day success story. Insights from a new infection prevention director with multi-center oversight.
Wow, that is very much so amazing. And I think that's something that's very much so needed within the profession of IP, with many IPs possibly seeking leadership roles. Explain how 90 days is an integral part of the start of a director role in IP.
Absolutely. So I will first start to say, obviously, every situation is different. I was going from one facility to another. So I didn't know what to expect when I got into that hospital. It was also a new program. So everybody's situation moving from a non-leadership role into a leadership role is going to have a little bit of a different experience than mine. But typically when you're talking about orientation, it's generally, I would say, 90 days. And that's an integral formative moment for anybody starting a new role, especially a new leader, because really, that's a make or break time period. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult transition. It's a challenging transition. And it's something that, if not defined, can really make or break somebody wanting to stay in that role.
Well, thank you for sharing your insights.
Yes, I noticed in the methods section, you mentioned relationship building and level setting with leadership. Tell me more about level setting and what you mean by that.
Absolutely. So when you're first starting in a leadership role, you know you're going to be steering the ship for the infection prevention program. You can only do that if you have buy-in at the top. And when you have buy-in at the top, it trickles down to the front line. It's a little bit different when you're coming in as a new staff-level infection preventionist and you're primarily working with frontline staff. As a director, you need to meet with your senior leadership, particularly those stakeholders that are integral to the infection prevention program, and then understand what it is they're looking for in the infection prevention program. And then by level setting, understanding what it is exactly that you are able to provide them. and what it is that you're going to bring into the program that's going to support their department.
I love that. I think that is a very, very good tip. So when you walked in the door in your first 90 days, who did you pick first and why to talk to?
It's tough because when you come in into a new leadership role, you need to identify who those stakeholders are. Mm-hmm. So typically you want to meet with everybody, all right. The leadership at the top, because yes. You don't know exactly who's going to be that yes. Integral stakeholder in your program, because you don't know what your threats and weaknesses are within your facility. So typically you want to meet with all your directors and then especially your C-suite, because at the end of the day, the C-suite kind of is steering the entire ship mm-hmm. for the facility. Typically, in my experience, infection prevention reports up through quality to the chief medical officer. So it's very important to establish that relationship early on. And then you're kind of operating between typically your COO, your chief operating officer, and your chief nursing officer. Mm-hmm. Nursing is probably one of the most important stakeholders that you have in your IP program. But you also have a lot of ancillary departments like construction and dietary and pharmacy and EVS that falls under your chief operating officer. So you need to make sure you have relationships at the top. Mm-hmm. And once you have that established, you can really start building relationships with the directors over those specific departments.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that really helps you decide what it is you're going to do next.
Absolutely. So just in thinking, pondering on your response, I know that it is very important to not only identify who those stakeholders are within the organization, but also to ascertain the work culture. What work culture are you walking into to better assess how you will lead your department? So what strategies did you use in order to identify what the work culture is and how it will impact your department?
Absolutely. So what I like to say is you're really going to understand the culture during your interview. I think you can pretty much identify the type of culture you're going to face when you're getting asked questions during that interview process. The culture can make or break an infection prevention program. So if you don't have the support at the top, you're not going to have the support at the bottom. So when you're going in and you're talking to these different directors and kind of getting an understanding of, do they even know what the infection prevention department does for them? Or do they have a strong idea of that? You can kind of get an idea of whether or not the IP program has been integrated into the facility or if they've been siloed for most of the history of that department. Mm-hmm. And that's typically when you're talking about multidisciplinary performance improvement and trying to make an effective infection prevention program work, it needs to be collaborative. Mm-hmm. So whether that culture already exists or if it's a culture that you need to start establishing, that's something you have to do within your first 90 days, because mm-hmm. your first impression is going to be your lasting impression on that hospital leadership. And like I said, if you don't have the leadership on your side, you're going to have a very difficult time moving forward with your program.
Absolutely. That's very important. And also garnering their trust in your capabilities is absolutely integral within that time frame. So what advice would you provide to IP seeking director in IP roles? In addition to that, how should they prepare for this transition into leadership?
So it really depends on, again, the situation that they're looking at. Are they looking internally or are they looking externally? Movement within infection prevention is not always easy, and it's very challenging, especially if you're moving into a facility where you're covering multiple sites, or it may just be a small facility that you're covering in the community. So if you're looking at moving into infection prevention leadership, typically what I say is find a mentor who's already in that leadership role. And then you'll typically have a manager or a director that you report to. But broach the idea of learning those leadership aspects. Because at the staff level, you have an idea about what the leader does, but you might not really know what the day-to-day looks like. So kind of getting some tips and tricks of what they did to move into leadership. Sometimes those leaders were voluntold that they're going to move into that job. But for the most part, from what I've experienced, is those particular leaders actually wanted to move into that role. So they're more than happy, at least I am, to help impart some level of experience and wisdom and how you can kind of make that transition.
Very good advice. You know, I'm picturing in my head you meeting with all of these directors and hearing their concerns with the infection prevention program. And I would imagine that everybody has their priorities of here is my fire, help me put it out. So how did you decide what is your biggest fire and where do we need to start?
Sure. So when I first got into that program, I essentially did what's called a SWOT analysis. And certain listeners may be familiar with that. So it's a QI process, a quality improvement process, where you're looking at based on your vantage point. So typically when I'm looking at internal and external factors that affect my vantage point is the infection prevention director, infection prevention department. So I'm looking at what our strengths are, what our weaknesses are internally, and then what our opportunities and threats are to the department itself. When I got into this role, we had our accreditation survey coming up imminently. So we know that during that accreditation survey, there's certain things that they're looking for that you, from your experience as a staff level IP, know it's something that you need to make sure is happening within your facility now as a leader. So things like high level disinfection or hand hygiene or sterilization and things like that, that we know are big ticket items that are being looked at. So you know that that's where you're going to be focusing most of your attention as you approach survey. What I like to do is build what's called a driver diagram. So you're looking at what it is your ultimate goal is, what your primary drivers are to reach that goal. So it could be your healthcare associated infections. And then what processes are feeding into those primary drivers. So you got your bundles, you got your cleaning and disinfection of equipment, you've got your environmental cleaning, you've got all those fun things. And based on what you've already evaluated with your program, you can then look at what immediate change ideas you already have. So that way, when you first meet with all these leaders, you're already, again, level setting exactly what you're focusing on already, what pertains to their department, and then how that's going to help them move forward as we approach survey.
Ben, thank you so much for sharing your project with us. It is such an insightful and needed topic within the field of infection prevention. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a great interview.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. It's good having you with us.
Thank you.
We are live at the APIC conference with a few guests that have a oral presentation coming up. We have Harry Zinn and Marissa Yi. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having us. Welcome to the show.
So the title of your presentation is Data Rather Than Germs: Leveraging Business Intelligence to Improve and Sustain Hand Hygiene. So what inspired this work that you have described?
Yes. So I think part of this was really a continuation of our overall continuous improvement for our hand hygiene program. We spent a lot of time and energy into improving our hand hygiene compliance. Really, the program started around 2015. And at that time, all our data was being collected through an internally developed app. Even before then, it was on paper. So there was a lot of manual labor in terms of collating the data, summarizing the data to share with our stakeholders, the units that we're actually observing. And part of that was because of the laborious nature of the data collection and summarization, we were really only able to share the data at the end of the reporting period, so at the end of the month. Then that kind of left, very little opportunity to kind of address low compliance throughout the observation timeframe. So we were trying to see, what are other ways or what tools are out there that can kind of help us, take away that manual labor piece, really increase real-time access or increase the access to having that data throughout the data period. That way units can actually know how they're doing. And if they're doing poorly, address that in that time frame. And so we found this software, and it really enabled us to connect our raw data source to it. And once you set it up, it'll just automatically update the data, do all that collating and summarizing, and really enable us to get that information back to our end users in real time so that they can actually respond.
That's fantastic. We all know the power of the real-time message. And so I think moving from that monthly, oh, here's your compliance of hand hygiene graph, you're actually sending it to them. Are they getting it on a weekly basis, a daily basis?
Yeah, so they can actually, you know, it's published online. So it's a URL they can go on whenever they want. Mm-hmm. But there's also a nice feature about this software in particular that we're using is that you can actually choose to get a subscription. So at whatever frequency you want, it'll come straight to your inbox. So you could get it daily if you want, or even at a weekly frequency. That way you're not, you know, too fatigued with getting these reports and almost become immune to checking.
Correct.
So it's really, I think that was a part that also kind of helped us be able to increase our compliance and also sustain that compliance is getting those reports.
That's amazing. And one of the things that I believe is absolutely important with such an initiative is to have buy-in from pertinent stakeholders, right? So how, walk us through that process of attaining buy-in from even executive leadership and all of the leaderships through leadership throughout the house to take on such a project and invest in this process.
Yeah. So I think thankfully for us, I think the software was already being used in our institution for other healthcare data reporting. Which is kind of why we ended up leveraging this specific software. I mean, I think hand hygiene at the time was really something that our chief medical officer at the time was really best invested in. He was actually one of our hand hygiene champions and really helped spearhead and provide that, you know, C-suite level support for improving our compliance. Because again, we know that hand hygiene is really the fundamental in infection prevention. It's the cornerstone, right? Dates back to 1860 when Florence Nightingale was pioneering hand hygiene and washing and stuff like that. So I think, you know, just because it's tied to so many prevention efforts that we really had that support. And, you know, our chief medical officer at the time was really great in supporting that work.
I love that buy-in from the top down. I think that's really powerful in making change when someone at that level is so invested in in an effort. So I heard you mention about sustaining change and sustaining hand hygiene compliance. How has this software helped you in that regard?
Yeah, so I think, again, because we're able to give that continuous feedback and it's really accessible to our, you know, end users, the ones, the staff that we're actually measuring compliance for, you know, they know, you know, on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week basis how they're doing. And, you know, it enables to have those conversations, you know, from nurse managers with their staff, but then also, you know, colleagues as well, right? They can say, you know, oh, we know how we're doing. We need to step it up if we're doing poorly. Or if we're doing great, we need to continue that, right? And I think when we initially published these dashboards in August of 2018, we were actually able to sustain 95% or greater compliance, which was kind of our internal target that we set as something attainable all the way to February 2020. So I think that's 16 consecutive months, which we had not had before. I mean, I think, you know, we would occasionally get up to 95%, but then, you know, next several months later, we'd fall back down to low 90s, upper 80s. So I think really having this new way of reporting our data and increasing that access really helped our sustainment efforts.
I agree. At the conference this week, I bumped into someone and she said that healthcare workers believe that they're washing their hands maybe 90% of the time or at every opportunity that they have. But in reality, maybe they're only washing their hands 30 to 40% of the time. So this would allow them to have that real-time feedback to say, hey, we know you think you're washing, but hey, we have an opportunity for improvement. And I think that that's a great way to change the behavior. Have you noticed any decrease in infection rates or any other positive outcomes associated with your program?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously there's always that cause and effect thing. Mm-hmm. But one of the other infection types that we actually like to, you know, graph coincide with our hand hygiene rates is usually our C. difficile infections. And, you know, obviously there's other work that goes into reducing C. diff infections in the hospital setting as well. But we do see, you know, as our hand hygiene compliance increases, you know, those hospital onset C. diff cases do trend down as well. So again, because hand hygiene is so important, especially, you know, with soap and water for a spore-forming organism such as C. diff, spread
out. Thank you for that. And one of the things that I really am curious about is who owns the process. I know some organizations and sites really struggle with the fact that infection prevention owns the process of hand hygiene because it can be labor intensive. So for this specific project, is it infection prevention? Is it quality?
So I think as a, you know, higher reliability organization, we try to not have one specific thing. Especially with something like hand hygiene, right? It's really an interdisciplinary subject that really needs to be addressed by all users. I do think, you know, us in infection prevention, we do take a lot of pride in spearheading it. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, it comes down to the actual caregivers, because we actually don't care for patients, right? It's the nurses, the physicians, you know, even our ancillary departments, EBS, they all play a role in preventing spread infections. So I do think, you know, having them engaged, involved, and we, you know, fortunately, we do have that here at our organization. And we, you know, have hand hygiene coach program as well, where it's really champions from different departments, really helping to push that forward.
Wow, that's such an amazing, amazing project. I thank you for sharing your experience regarding this initiative with us and with our listeners. We are here today with an additional special guest. We have Emily Gaddam, who has an oral presentation at the APIC conference. The title of her presentation is Candida auris, a team-based approach to taming the wild beast. Welcome, Emily.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I am so excited to be here today.
The pleasure is ours.
And I'm honored because this is really the work of an entire team of people. It's not just about me. So I'm so happy that I get the chance to highlight the work that we've done.
Thank you so much, Emily. So what prompted the need for developing a Candida auris screening process within the facility?
I think, you know, C. auris, it was first identified in 2009 from a patient's ear in Japan. And at that time, they weren't very concerned about it because new organisms or species sometimes pop up from time to time. But as time went on, and particularly, I think it was around 2015 in the UK, they realized there was like an outbreak of Candida auris in a cardiac unit. And that was very concerning. And so 2016 was around when the CDC started issuing alerts to healthcare facilities. And in 2018 and 2019 was when in Southern California, we started to see the prevalence in the community going way up. So we wanted to be ready for when it came to our facility.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
That it sounds like you were all very proactive in your approach when addressing Candida auris. So what were some of the, tell us a little bit about the implementation as far as the screening process goes. Were patients isolated during, while you were waiting on testing results? How did you kind of implement some of the strategies?
So I think what the biggest issue was, not for just our facility, but for all facilities, is that screening tests are not readily available. So if you don't have a screening test, how are you going to be able to identify patients? And if you can't identify patients, you can't take extra precautions with those patients. Mm-hmm. So really, the number one priority was developing our microbiology lab. Like, we're fortunate to have the expertise in our lab to be able to develop a screening test. And so they were able to switch from, you know, what previously was passive surveillance, where you might just happen to see C. auris pop up in a blood culture, to a more proactive approach where, you know, we could do molecular testing on high-risk patients as soon as they were admitted.
How did you identify those high-risk patients? What did you decide was the key factor in triggering this response?
Yes. So I think it was based on our patient population as well as a literature review. And of course, all of that went through then, you know, our infection prevention and control committee as well to determine what the screening criteria was. And then from there, once we had the criteria, we were able to integrate that into a best practice alert, because there were huge knowledge gaps. I don't know if you remember, like, talking to people, like, people had never even heard about Canada Auris or Sea Auris. And so having that best practice alert really sort of engineered the process into our system.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. So has this screening program bolstered partnerships with other healthcare organizations, maybe to promote continuity of care?
So I think there's still a lot of work to be done. Mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of brag on my chapter for a minute from Greater Los Angeles APIC.
Absolutely.
I just heard them present the work that Waltina Brooks and Jessica Resende have been doing with partnering with the skilled nursing facilities and providing them with extra support, because there's still so much to do, you know, with partnerships with these skilled nursing facilities. You know, they often don't have the same resources that acute care hospitals have or large academic medical centers have. So many, you know, hospitals still and skilled nursing, long-term care, they still don't have, you know, a way to screen patients for Sea Auris, and it's a major problem.
Thank you for identifying that. So maybe for future researchers or organizations, just to identify a possible fix for that gap in resources for those organizations.
Absolutely.
Yes. I love that you are able to screen for these patients, identify these patients, and then we know as they're discharged into the next level of care that we have to alert these organizations about what we know about the patient as they're receiving them. But you really highlighted a point that you can't just tell them and then be like, okay, see you later, you know, good luck. Like, we have a huge gap to fill and knowledge and education that we need to also impart on the post-acute world with this information. So that is very, very helpful.
I think we're going to see more of this. I know CEDARS has done some work, CEDARS-Sinai, where we've, you know, partnered with some of the skilled nursing facilities in our areas to try to improve some infection prevention practices, both around antibiotic stewardship, as well as like Foley catheters and preventing, you know, catheter-associated infections. And I think, like, as we see more people move from, like, a fee-for-service model in our healthcare to a population model, that, like, hopefully, you know, the skilled nursing facilities and long-term care are going to be getting more of the research, like, resources that will be caring for a whole population versus just seeing it as, this is what we're doing in our facility, because that's not going to, like, prevent, you know, across the country.
Right, for population-based improvement. We have to start somewhere. And getting this message out, I think, is a very good place to start.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. That's why I'm so excited to share, like, our workflows. Yes. And hopefully other people can also adopt.
It's definitely going to be something that's helpful. So in this process, one of the things that I think all of us can identify with is the importance of EVS and the partnership of EVS. They definitely play an integral part in this in instituting this initiative.
Our EVS is phenomenal, and we're so lucky to have great relationships with our EVS team. I did make it a point, like, for my presentation to have a picture of all the different teams that you really have to work with if you're in infection prevention and control, because you need to know all these people and you need to be able to work together as a team.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, we actually have a daily list. So anytime we have Sea Auris patients in the hospital or we know of a new patient that's newly positive, we actually notify our EVS leadership of those rooms and they get twice daily bleach cleaning.
Okay. So the expectation is that EVS leadership disseminates that information out to frontline EVS staff.
Yes. So they have their very involved leadership. They do ATP testing as well as like the glow germ or fluorescent validation on their cleaning as well.
I would just like to say, I would like to give a shout out to all of our EVS teammates. Your partnership is definitely key in preventing infections.
Very important position.
Yes. So they're doing so much behind the scenes, yes. and they're really healthcare heroes yes. that yes. never get recognized. Yes. And it's very sad.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I agree. And so you mentioned the validation process is the fluorescence. Mm-hmm. And now is EVS doing that, or is that IP that's going in to do that validation process?
Yeah. So I believe EVS leadership does the validation, but the reports get disseminated to the unit managers too. And so, and they also get presented in our infection prevention and control committee meetings. And so we have dashboards for the ATP testing as well.
Okay, wow. Great. So were there any challenges, like for our listeners today walking away, when you were implementing this, was there a main challenge that we could avoid? In hindsight, was there something that you found out along the way that we could implement now?
I mean, I think the biggest challenge is still developing the screening test. Mm-hmm. And it takes time, right? So developing a screening test, there's not one that's just FDA approved and like, this is how we're going to screen patients. And so I think looking from a high level, how are we going to support hospitals and skilled nursing facilities and long-term care in being able to develop these screening tests?
Absolutely.
It's a real challenge.
It is a real challenge. Mm-hmm. Does your system have a way to alert you to these patients as they come back in? We know that people can go from skilled nursing back to acute. Is there a way that you're identifying those patients as they may float through the healthcare system?
Thank you. Yes, that was another big piece of mm-hmm. our bundle, which is that anytime we get a positive CORIS result from the lab on the patient, that information goes from our lab to our infection control software, and then that triggers an email. So we get a notification. And additionally, we worked with our EIS team so that anytime in the electronic health record, a patient is admitted, discharged, or transferred, we also get an email alert. Mm-hmm.
And in case any of us do not know what EIS is, what does that stand for?
So Enterprise Information System, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the computer folks.
I love that.
Absolutely.
And leveraging your data.
Yes.
And thank you for sharing. This is absolutely integral that we implement measures in order to definitely put a dent in Canada Ours and the increase in infections that we're seeing. Emily, thank you so much for joining the show and providing us with and sharing your knowledge.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. I feel so flattered to be here. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Emily. It was so great to have you. And we really can't wait to see what you bring to us next year.
Thank you. And to all of our listeners, the presentations and the presenters that provided their insights and shared their presentations, just know that you will have access to them until November online. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to APIC's 5 Second Rule Show. We want to hear from you. Visit us at www.5secondruleshow.org. That's with the number 5, where you can contribute to the conversation. Make sure you subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're so appreciative of the hard work each of you do every day to make a safer world through infection prevention. Remember, IP stands for important person. You are awesome. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.